Schwein, and I teach at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. And my training is in creative writing more, poetry especially. So a lot of times when I'm reading a poem, I'm not reading it from the sort of more perspective of having a lot of background in a specific time period. I'm just reading it as a poet, as somebody who loves to write, who's looking at a poem as a writer. So for that reason, if there's other folks who do know a lot about, I mean, the great thing about Holden is you usually have people chipping in who actually know like five times more about, you know, some aspect of the subject than you do, which is terrific. So please, you know, chip in with your knowledge, and you know, it's always a Holden discussion, so we want everyone's voices and to contradict one another, and that's great and lovely and a part of things. And so today we're going to look at two poems, flower poems. I wore my little maternity smock here with the flowers on it. It's kind of a thematic representation. The first poem we're going to look at is by a guy named George Herbert. Does anybody know George Herbert? Yeah? Fabulous. Good. And so George Herbert lived, just a little background here, from 1593 to 1633. His mom was John Donne's patron, so there's a little connection there. He's in 1627, he took holy orders in the Church of England and became a rector. So very, as you'll see, this poem is quite religious in its and its subject and theme and all that kind of stuff. He is considered one of the metaphysical poets. And the metaphysical poets we talked a little bit about yesterday were very interested in sort of figuring things out in a rational way through poetry. And a lot of times they used what we would call conceits or extended metaphors for something as a way to kind of wrap their minds around a spiritual or philosophical question. And so we'll see that in this poem and kind of try to track what the flower sort of becomes for George Herbert. My favorite little line here is, he wrote all these poems, didn't have them published during his lifetime, on his deathbed, gave them to a friend and said, if you think that any of these poems could help any dejected poor soul, then you should publish. So we're gonna hope they help our dejected poor souls today. As we talk about these two poems, the second poem we're gonna read, and we're gonna get to it today, we didn't get to the other poem yesterday, but we are gonna get to the second one today, is by a poet named Louise Gluck. Is anybody familiar with her? Yeah, she was poet laureate actually a couple years ago, and we're going to look at a book or a poem from her book called The Wild Iris, which I would highly recommend even if you're not a super poetry person or something, but I assume all of you kind of are, that's why you're here. But her book The Wild Iris won the Pulitzer Prize, and many of the poems in the book are written from the perspective of flowers. So the person speaking in the poem is a flower, as we will learn in her poem today. So very interesting and accessible, but with lots of layers of depth too.
I think it was in the library, although poetry books in the library tend to disappear.
It might also be, it's been in the bookstore before. I don't know if it is now, but I should have looked before I came over today. Yeah, and as we just, during the week, we're looking at poems that deal with nature in some way. And so sort of thinking about this question overall of what is the speaker's relationship to nature. And specifically today, looking at these poems, both of them have the same subject and theme, but the poet's approach is sort of vastly different. So also sort of thinking about which of these poems is more successful at talking about these themes. Sometimes at Holden we don't like to be competitive, but we're going to be competitive about these two poems. You're going to have to decide which one you think is better. I'm just going to make a choice, and why we think that. So we'll begin with Flower by George Herbert. And I'm actually, usually I have somebody else read. I'm gonna read it just because, and hopefully you'll hear this as it goes. His syntax, that is the order he puts the words in, and the rhythm is a little bit tricky in some places. And see if you can just sort of hear that as we read it. Okay, the flower. How fresh, O Lord, how sweet and clean are thy returns, even as the flowers in spring, to which, besides their own demean, the late past frosts tributes of pleasure bring. Grief melts away like snow in May, as if there were no such cold thing. Who would have thought my shriveled heart could have recovered greenness? It was gone quite underground, as flowers depart to see their mother root, when they have blown, where they together all the hard weather, dead to the world, keep house unknown. These are thy wonders, Lord of power, killing and quickening, bringing down to hell and up to heaven in an hour, making a chiming of a passing bell. We say amiss this or that is, thy word is all, if we could spell. Oh, that I once past changing were, fast in thy paradise where no flower can wither. Many a spring I shoot up fair, offering at heaven, growing and groaning thither. Nor doth my flower want a spring shower, my sins and I joining together. But while I grow in a straight line, still upwards bent as if heaven were mine own, thy anger comes and I decline. What frost to that? What pole is not the zone where all things burn when thou dost turn and the least frown of thine is shown? And now in age I bud again. After so many deaths I live and write. I once more smell the dew and rain and relish versing. Oh, my only light, it cannot be that I am he on whom thy tempests fell all night. These are thy wonders, Lord of love, to make us see we are but flowers that glide, which when we once can find and prove, thou hast a garden for us where to bide. Who would be more, swelling through store, forfeit their paradise by their pride. Okay. Any just initial reactions? They can be very honest, very... We'll go through the poem fairly slowly and methodically, but if anybody wants to just...
I was just thinking, what frame of mind do you think is in at the time he wrote this? I'm like, what season of the year?
Great. Certainly seasons of the year are going to play a huge role. Yeah, right. Absolutely. And his frame of mind, right? Which I think switches in different places throughout the poem. So that's a great thing that we should sort of track as we talk about it, yeah. Okay, well, let's just go sort of stanza by stanza here, right? So does anybody want to reread the first stanza? Anyone feel? Thanks, Ingrid.
How fresh, O Lord, how sweet and clean are they, are thy returns, even as the flowers in spring, to which, beside their own demean, the late post-frost's tribute of pleasure bring. Grief melts away like snow in May, as if there were no such cold thing.
Thanks. So as soon as we hear this first line, how fresh, O Lord, how sweet and clean are thy returns, what sorts of things do we know about the speaker, the person who's saying this poem?
His heart is full and happy at this point.
All right. How do you know?
Because he's going, oh my God, look, there's pretty flowers there.
Yay. Yeah, right? Fresh, sweet, clean, right? Right? What else do we know about the speaker?
Religion plays some role.
Okay, yes. Speaker's talking to God here, right? And religion seems to be important. What do you guys make, and this is not something where I have a right answer at all. The word returns here. How fresh, O Lord, how sweet and clean are thy returns. What could returns mean?
the yearly seasons card again.
Okay.
So spring sort of? Is that what you mean? Like, or just the cycle of the seasons?
The cycle of the seasons.
Okay.
But then he says spring in the same line.
Okay, great. What else?
Could mean the Lord coming back to him after some feeling of being abandoned.
Or blessings.
Great.
Could be Easter.
Okay.
In which God sort of providentially enacts different times of seasons, Lent and then Easter.
Grief and death and dying and return.
Great.
Could mean return on interest on previous investment of energy or work or something.
Okay, yeah. Great. Anything else?
Maybe the return of things that had died or withered during the winter.
Great.
And are now growing again.
Right. So growing things specifically. What growing thing might you think we're talking about based on that title?
A flower.
Yes, excellent job. You're all brilliant. Okay, so in this first line, we're dealing with a speaker who's in a place of praise and seems pretty happy, is interested in God, and has already thrown us one word that has all of these different sort of valences and possibilities, right? That could play out in different ways. Okay. So we get the returns, and then even as the flowers in spring. So how is he using that even as?
He's saying this is like it, but
like.
It's not it.
Okay. So yeah, even as is sort of a like. So that helps us with that sort of reading of returns. And then, to which besides their own demean, the late past frost tributes of pleasure bring. And this is where syntactically he's starting to do sort of interesting things, because it's the, well, does somebody want to unpack that sentence there? Yes.
In between the commas, besides their own domain, doesn't have to be there, so I would read it, even as the flowers in spring to which the late past frosts tributes of pleasure bring.
Great. So the flowers are bringing tributes of pleasure to the frosts, right? Is that?
The frosts are bringing tributes of pleasure to the flowers.
How did other people read that? So I think that they're bringing it. See, I think this is where he's syntactically reversed it. Because even as the flowers in spring, to which the flowers to which the flowers bring to the frost, right? But again, it's the interesting thing is that it's confusing, right? It's not immediately clear who's bringing what to whom, because he also has the besides their own demean in there, right? Which you, I think, very clearly, I mean, that phrase can be taken out.
Well, then, to add to the confusion,
yeah.
Going back, he follows the same sort of pattern in almost all the stanzas. In the second line of each stanza, we have a stop in the middle.
Okay.
Or thy return, exclamation mark, you stop. And then going forward a little bit, you have the question mark in another comma. You stop always in the middle of the second line. And so that just adds another rhythmic confusion.
Yes, and we're going to talk, well, we could talk right now about why this is sort of a formally awkward poem, rhythmically. When you look at the poem, does everything look sort of regular?
Mm-hmm.
Do all the stanzas look the same?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right? And could anybody tell us what the rhyme scheme is? back. We'll just take a little trip back here to English days. Anybody want to bust out what the rhyme scheme is?
A B C C.
A B yeah.
A B A B C C B.
A B C C what?
C C B.
C C B. Okay. So, and does it look like, for the most part, as you look through, like he pretty much follows that same rhyme scheme throughout?
Yeah.
So the rhyme scheme is consistent. And visually, the poem looks really consistent, right? But as Heidi's pointed out, he's doing this weird thing where in the second line, there's often a pause with a comma or a question mark. So that kind of starts to throw things off. The other thing he's doing, this is going to be a real English major moment here. So there's two different, when we talk about meter and rhythm, we can talk about accentual and accentual syllabic. And accentual rhythm is when you just count the syllables, okay? Lots of nursery rhymes, you just count the stressed syllables, okay? So like, maybe a poem that we recognize. Okay, so when you're doing Ba Ba Black Sheep to your child, for instance, right, you're saying it, where, on what syllables do you put stress? Yeah, you can say Ba Ba Black Sheep.
Aren't those all monosyllabic words?
Yep, they all have, a lot of them are single syllable, but like where do we put this, okay, let's all say it together. All right, ready?
Ba, ba, black sheep, have you any wool? Yes, sir, three bags full.
Okay, so when we get to have you any wool, right? We start, have you any wool? Yes, sir, three bags full, right? Or Ba ba black sheep. Right? We all kind of agree? Okay. Great. So here the pattern is two stressed syllables, two stressed syllables, two stressed syllables, and two stressed syllables, right? The pattern that in each line there's two stressed syllables is consistent. But that's a little mark we use for an unstressed syllable. That part of the pattern is not consistent. Okay? So in a lot of nursery rhymes, what we're feeling when we do a nursery rhyme, there can be lots of unstressed syllables between the stressed syllables as long as the stressing is consistent in the stressed ones. Okay. Yes, are we all understanding? Fabulous. Okay. So if we take we'll take a different nursery rhyme, because not all nursery rhymes work like this, but okay, let's say this one together. Ready?
Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water.
Jack
fell down and broke his crown, and Jill came tumbling after.
Okay, so here we have Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water.
Jack fell down and broke his crown, and Jill came tumbling after.
Okay, so what do you notice about this one?
4-3, 4-3.
Yep. And what we would do, and sort of divide this up into what we would call meat or whatever, right? But we've got four stressed syllables, then three stressed syllables, then four stressed syllables, and three stressed syllables, right? So we have a pattern there. What's also consistent is the unstressed syllables between the stressed syllables, okay? So that's accentual syllabic verse because you're counting both the stressed and unstressed syllables. Here it's just the stressed ones that matter. Here it's both. Does that make sense? Kind of? Okay, so part of what, and we could probably spend this entire time just dissecting the rhythm in this poem, but part of the reason it feels weird is that sometimes Herbert is using this kind of meter, and sometimes he's using the other kind. So when we have these little lines, grief melts away like snow in May, right? That's that same nursery rhyme kind of feeling. But a lot of his other lines are this accentual syllabic verse. And that really messes with us in terms of knowing how to read this, right? Because when you're in nursery rhyme mode, you sort of know how to do that kind of reading. And once you find a rhythm here, Jack and Jill, right? All of you kind of got into the da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? Like, we know how to do that. But when you're moving back and forth, it's it feels a little bit funky. And so part of what he's doing in this poem is, even though it looks really perfect and sort of nice on the outside, he's doing some shifty, rocky things to us as we read through that are kind of sneaky. So there's a feeling of both being kind of balanced and unbalanced at the same time. Okay, so let's move on. Who wants to read? Okay, so we've got the grief melting away like snow in May, as if there were no such cold thing, right? So we've got the Anybody want to say anything about that before we go on? Yes, Ingrid.
In reading it, I was very conscious of the fresh, sweet, clean at the beginning, and already by the end of the stanza, we're saying, as if there were no such cold thing.
Okay.
Which is very ominous.
So the grief, it's nice that the grief is melting away, but then this as if prepares us in some ways for what's going to come next.
I think even those first lines, somehow, even though they're sort of bright, they're a little like tinge of sadness to them.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. do you want to read the second stanza?
Sure. Who would have thought my shriveled heart could have recovered greenness? It was gone, quite underground, as flowers depart to see their mother leave, and they have gone. Were they together, all the hard weather, dead to the world keep house unknown. It is.
Isn't it, right? It's a little hard to read. Okay. So yeah, what's going on in this stanza? What's he talking about?
Flowers disappearing.
Flowers disappearing, yes.
Sounds like he's... he has some grief issues that he...
That's a great way to put it, Wanda. It does sound like he has some grief issues.
My shriveled heart. Who would have thunk it that my grief could have turned to greenness?
Yes. So what's the comparison that's being made here that he's bringing up here?
How in winter you can't imagine that flowers would come out.
Yep. But they sort of have this time of growing underground. But what, but his shriveled heart, right, is the thing is what?
Underground.
Is underground, yeah. That's one of these shriveled green things, right, that goes underground. And specifically, as flowers depart, right, to see their mother root when they have blown. And then, where are they together, all the hard weather, dead to the world, keep house unknown. So does this sound like a fun time in life?
Not a time of promise yet to come.
A time of promise yet to come.
Yet to come.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and it's nice to think all those dead flowers, you know, I always grieve the first night of a hard frost because all my back porch flowers are all still really blooming and working hard to stay colorful. And I know they're all going to be dead by morning. But now here it says that they're all going to be together.
That is kind of a nice
cozy
thing.
Little house with their mother.
With their mother. Where are they together all the hard weather? Those two lines are sort of nice and sweet and feel kind of communal. But then that last line, dead to the world, keep house unknown, is a, it's a little bit sadder.
Well, yeah. I read that as, the world sees them as dead, uh-huh. but really they're keeping house somewhere
okay.
that we don't know about.
So the unknown is to us.
Right.
What we don't know about. Yeah, Desi, what were you going to say?
That's exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like sad, but not despairing.
Right.
Yeah. All right, let's find out what happens next. Who wants to read the third stanza?
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
I'll give it a try. These are thy wonders, Lord of power, killing and quickening, bringing down to hell and up to heaven in an hour, making a chiming of a passing bell. We say amiss, this or that is. The word is all, if we could spell.
I love that line. So what's going on here?
To me, it reads to me that he's saying God's in power of taking care of all of this.
Yep. Okay, so that this cycle is part of God's wonder, right?
Mm-hmm.
The killing and quickening, bringing down to hell and up to heaven in an hour, right? And if you read the note below, the passing bell is told to announce that death, but a chiming offers a pleasing variety, right? So we're also getting the contrast of the death bell, but the sort of light, the lightness of the chime with that sound, right? How do you guys read the, we say amiss, this or that is? What's the this or that referring to?
Unknowledge, our knowledge of stuff. So
okay.
We have opinions, but that's all they are.
Okay.
I read it in relation to that line just previous to it, like, that person is dead, or the flower is gone.
And we think that that's a bad thing.
Uh-huh. Or the person is dead, but then another
we're
dead.
Missing the greater sort of
yeah.
language or word here, yeah.
Well, I read it according to the last line where I almost wonder if thy word, the word, the W of word, would be capitalized, suggesting that we don't understand. So what do we force back upon to sort of make sense of death, which is God's revelation?
Yeah.
That's all we have.
Yeah, it's odd that he doesn't capitalize it, because like in the next stanza, paradise is capitalized, and certainly capable of capitalizing. But maybe because it's with the if we could spell line, maybe it's kind of
yeah.
a play, you know, he's purposefully putting an error in there just to... Though, and interestingly enough, I don't know if this spell part has to do with the, I mean, obviously it's part of a rhyme, but spelling is what you do when you yourself are writing the words, right? And so it's almost like it should be if we could read. Like, your word is all, if only we could read it, right? But God, theoretically, should be the one doing the spelling with God's own words, right?
The meaning of the word may change slightly.
Yeah.
Interpretation of it.
So maybe it's the spelling.
Spell also means rest.
Oh.
That's
a great...
Yeah.
Interesting.
Oh, that's
a
great
different.
Thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
if we could just
yeah.
chill out and
uh-huh.
be okay with this resting time,
yeah.
everything would be all right. Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Thanks,
very
Andy.
Good.
Wow.
Science and poetry.
Look at the flowers at the nano level.
Yes.
Next time.
Surface area,
that's right. All right, we're going to keep going. I know there's tons in each of these things, but I swear we're making it to the next poem, so okay. Can we have a male voice read this next stanza? Since we haven't heard any guy want to step forward, be brave.
Not
fabulous.
Oh, that I once passed changing were fast in thy paradise, where no flower can wither. Many a spring I shoot up fair, offering at heaven, growing and groaning thither. Nor doth my flower want a spring shower, my sins and I joining together.
All right. So what does the speaker desire? What would be really nice in the speaker's mind?
To be dead?
Well, if he could just skip, he's tired of the whole cycle thing, right? The cycle, the dying, the coming back, blah, blah, blah. If only he could be in paradise, where you just get to be the flower part all the time, and you don't have to do the dying thing once a year, right? You could just skip right to the growing and flourishing part, right?
In other words, just wishing it can just go straight to heaven?
Yeah, right? Yeah, just be in that zone.
Or that heaven could be here so that we didn't have to.
Right.
Yeah.
Go through all these
cycles of pain and grief. Yeah.
But I also see the hint, especially based on the previous hint, about sort of the Garden of Eden, in which, you know, especially really Christian doctrine, believe that sin led to death, and there was no death before sin. So here you have, especially at the last moment, my sins and I joined together, meaning my sins being the cause of the grief and the death, that I'm trapped in this sort of providential, seasonal life.
Of the cycle of the, yeah.
And why can't we get back there?
Yeah, so paradise being both heaven and Eden at the same time.
The past and sort of the future.
That's great. Okay, who wants to take a shot at the next stanza? Thanks.
But while I grow in a straight line, still upwards bent, as if heaven were mine own, thy anger comes and I decline. What frost to that? What pole is not the zone where all things burn when thou dost turn? And at least frown of thine is shown. Sorry.
No, it's not an easy poem to read. And I do think the note here is helpful in sort of explaining the second half of the, because again, the syntax is a little bit strange. So what's going on here? What happens? Like the speaker's, he's growing in that he's in the springtime and he's growing up straight as he can. He's feeling like heaven's, he's almost there to heaven. What stops that? God's wrath. Yeah. Yeah. What do you guys make of that?
Doesn't matter how straight you want to grow or. I don't know. You don't have control of it. God is able to bring the frost just as the kind of God giveth and taketh away. Okay.
So just when you think you might make it.
You think.
He's not wrong.
But it's not just a natural progression in this case. It's an actual striking down.
Yeah,
so.
It's the anger.
And it's like as if heaven were my own. To me it sounds like he's, that's like, I'm in charge of all this. I'm taking good care of this. And it's all because of me that I'm growing straight and strong. And
right.
That's when.
So lest we think that thy anger comes out of nowhere in this poem, right? As if heaven were mine own, what sin, what might we kind of. What? Pride, right? Yeah. Right. And we also got in the previous line, these sort of admittances about, you know, that the my here has some sins going on too, right? So we've already gotten the hint at that. So it's not like the speaker's living a perfect life. So we have this sort of pride, God's anger follows, and that's sort of what stops.
Which jumping ahead to the last stanza.
Yes. Very good. Prefigures the last sort of line. So we're already hinting at the pride before we get back there. Okay, next stanza. Who wants to take a shot? Great.
And now in age I bud again. After so many deaths, I live and write. I once more smell the dew and rain and relish versing. Oh, my only light, it cannot be that I am he on whom thy tempests fell all night.
All right, so how's the speaker feeling in this stanza?
Older.
Yep. I'm old and this is still happening, this thing where things go well and then not so well, this cycle, right?
But he's having a rebirth anyway.
Yep. The rebirth is still going, and he's tying the relishing of versing, right? The writing comes back. And he kind of can't, it's hard to believe that I was that guy that all those horrible things were happening to, you know? So as the cycle happens, it's like we come back and it's like we almost forget how horrible it was to die that death of grief or loss or whatever it is, so that there's some promise in that too. Any other thoughts about that stanza?
Is it unusual in the 1600s to write about writing? To be so reflexive about it, or no?
That's a good question.
Maybe that's a question for another time.
Yeah. Or a question for one of those people that knows a lot about I mean, I could give you an answer that I made up if you'd like that, but I'm a creative writer, so I can always supply answers. They just sound like I got to be true.
Shakespeare is writing at the same time too, and so there's just a lot of writing going on and a lot of performing these writings. It's not just like the aristocrats who are writing and reading and everything like that. It's becoming a lot more of a public thing. And so it seems like it just with that idea it would be logical to write about writing because it's just in more people's mind.
I certainly noticed that Shakespeare will slip out of character and speak directly to the audience.
Okay.
And that poets of that time period probably do something similar, speaking of themselves rather than of their subject or their point of view.
So this is a moment where we're getting more of insight into really who the speaker is on a more sort of practical personal level.
When you said that on his deathbed is when he actually allowed him to be published.
Yes.
So, at this point...
He's getting closer to that. Yeah. Great. All right, last stanza. Who wants to wrap it up who hasn't read it?
These are thy wonders, Lord of Love, to make us see we are but flowers that glide, which when we once can find and prove, thou hast a garden for us where to bide. Who would be more, swelling through store, forfeit their paradise by their pride?
Ooh. What do you guys, so what's going on here? What's the ultimate sort of message? I think I can even say message. Cause...
If you're too proud, you're giving up heaven?
Yep. Right? The final thing here is if you forfeit, right, paradise. Through pride, which we, I don't even remember. Tell me your name.
Claire.
So Claire brought up the pride moment earlier. What else is he saying in this stanza?
Kind of an allusion to fate. You can't change it. We are but flowers that glide.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and if you look down, the glide there pass silently away. So at some level, again, we're getting this comparison, right? The whole thing has been a conceit about us. He was a flower first. Turns out we're all flowers, right? That live this cycle that pass silently away. Which when we once can find and prove or experience, then that's when we get sort of entrance to the garden. Once we've accepted this sort of cycle of transience, that we're here and then we're gone, that's sort of part of what we need to come to understand before we get entrance to paradise. Our own sort of vulnerability or fragility is part of what we need to... Is that how other people are reading it?
To me, it seemed that when we find and prove or understand that God is in control, that God has a garden for us to bide in, then why would we want to continue our prideful ways and give up paradise instead,
right.
To have our own pride.
Great.
So. Of course, it's a different image of God.
Okay, yes.
It's a really different tone. I mean, if you, especially compared to the stanza 15 through 21, these are thy wonders, Lord of power. Mm-hmm. These are thy wonders, Lord of love.
Love, right.
So it's a movement almost from here I am finally recognizing the fact that when I puff myself up like a flower in the spring, I think I'm in control. And I'm not.
Yes.
And yet, here is this Lord of love.
And that's a great thing to note, too, that that's the one line where we get some sort of repetition. And so the change from power to love is definitely important there. Though it's interesting to me that he ends, I mean, it's such a nice moment where when we once confined and proved thou hast a garden for us where to bide. I keep thinking, like, that would be such a nice place to end the poem. But then he tacks on the three other lines. They're like, unless you're really prideful, in which case, too bad for you.
I maybe stand for all sin.
Sure.
You know,
the belief in Christian theology that you have been familiar with is that the root of all evil is self-love, which is pride.
Okay.
And that's the cause of sin. Adam and Eve sinned because they disobeyed God, thinking they had answers. They could choose to eat the fruit.
Oh, so
consequently, pride is self-love, and we don't need God.
Pride goes before the fall.
So that's where everything begins.
So it's a classic bipolar poem.
That's right. It's true. Both in the content, right? But also in, as we talked about, in the form, like the form itself, the way the words are written, have this sort of bipolar sense where you think you're in one rhythm and then you're in the other rhythm, and you know, is this power or love? What's going on? Okay, I always happens where we don't have that much time now for the wild iris. But we will read this through, and then maybe I'll make some comments about it, and you guys can also jump in. Who would like to read? Is there anybody who hasn't read yet?
I'll read.
Thank you.
At the end of my suffering, there was a door. Hear me out. That which you call death, I remember. Overhead, noises, branches of the pine shifting, then nothing. The weak sun flickered over the dry surface. It is terrible to survive as consciousness buried in the dark earth. Then it was over, that which you fear, being a soul and unable to speak, ending abruptly, the stiff earth bending a little, and what I took to be birds darting in low shrubs. You who do not remember passage from the other world, I tell you I could speak again. Whatever returns from oblivion returns to find a voice. From the center of my life came a great fountain, deep blue shadows on azure seawater.
Okay. What is this? Okay. So I said that both poems have the same subject and theme, right? What would we say, I mean, what's the sort of superficial subject of both poems?
Death and rebirth.
Well, I would call that more theme. What's the superficial subject?
Flowers,
right? We've got flowers, though in this poem we have the flower doing some talking, right? So both have the same superficial subject, the flower, and both have the same theme of death and rebirth, okay? So both are after some of the same things. What's different about this one? What do you guys notice? We'll do sort of just a general, say whatever you want about it, because we don't have much time left.
A lot fewer words,
yes.
It doesn't do the back and forth oscillating between joy and sadness.
Okay.
It starts with the suffering and ends with the rebirth.
Okay, great. And so sort of, and tonally, the sort of tone of it is pretty in that kind of serious, reflective kind of mode the whole time. We don't start out with like, Lord, the spring is beautiful. Okay.
Yeah.
What else?
Yeah, in other words, it's not a Shakespearean language.
Yes.
It's like the period is much more modern.
Yes. Much more modern, contemporary, the language. And do we have all these crazy rhythms going on?
No, it's much more conversational sort of speech, simpler words. Anybody else jump in?
Well, there's, especially the last stanza, consider my life came a deep, great month. I mean, there's this affirmation of natural life being sort of the center of rebirth.
Yeah.
In which all of us, or all life must have connection or some center in this fountain.
Okay, and let's, okay, so part of the question is, the speaker here, the flower, the wild iris here, right, is describing, I'm going to say her. Yeah, I'm just going to do that. Yeah, yeah. Her death and rebirth, right? Essentially, that's what's happening here. Just as Herbert describes the flowers undergoing this, right? But we're getting it from the perspective of the flower. That which you call death, I remember. So we're going through what death actually feels like, the experience of it, right? Rather than hearing about it as a metaphor, we're going through what this actually might feel like to the flower itself, right? But we end up, the last two stanzas are very interesting in terms of these colons that are in there. So we get, because in writing, you sort of think of the colon, right, as like an equal sign, right? So that whatever's on one side is equivalent to whatever is on the other side of it. Yes, sort of? Is this kind of ringing true for people? So when she has these sort of three phrases that are joined by these colons, in some ways it's sort of a building up of these sort of equivalencies in some ways. And the first thing, you who do not remember passage from the other world, I tell you I could speak again. So like, here's what happened. Here's the action. For those, I could speak again. And then we have the equivalency, which suggests that maybe it's the speech itself, right? This is the, I could speak again. Here's what it was. Whatever returns from oblivion returns to find a voice, right? So we have a sort of message there. But then the voice itself, right? We have—it's like we have a voice within a voice within a voice, right? It's these three sort of layers at the end, and then the third part, which Petter was commenting on, where we end in this poem that, as you mentioned, is tonally pretty dark the whole time, right? From the center of my life came a great fountain, deep blue shadows on azure seawater, which we could spend a lot of time just thinking about how, I mean, the azure seawater with these dark blue shadows on top. I mean, that's just gorgeous in general, right? But the question becomes, is this, I mean, certainly that's a natural image, right, of water being the thing that gives the plant life again, that causes the growth. But, I mean, certainly we can also read it as, what else?
The iris is the shape of a fountain.
Oh, that's true.
Is that what you were asking?
No, but that's beautiful. No, that's great.
And there are bluish irises, right?
Oh, yeah.
They're bluish. They're more purpley.
Oh, yeah, the wild flowers. And then also the only voice that a flower has is its beauty, is its color.
Oh, that's very true. But in terms of what, for Herbert, right, in this poem, what is it that brings the flower back to life, ultimately?
God,
right? Mm-hmm. So Gluck's not going to say that. I mean, for her, it's going to, at some level, be the natural rain. But the other question is her last stanza the experience of God? Does that make sense? Like, is she, could we take that to be an actual trying to tell us what it would be like to have God bringing you back to life? Herbert tells us that it happens. Mm-hmm. Is she giving us the experience of it happening, of what it would feel like, or what the image would be of God actually coming to you in that moment of grief? What that would, how we would see that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So what I kind of want to suggest with these two poems is that, you know, Herbert does a lot of talking about the event, right? This is what it's about, as we talked about with the metaphysical poets. he's trying to kind of figure out this spiritual question via kind of talking through it, reasoning through it. We did a lot of reasoning through his words and what things meant. And that Gluck, at some level, though she's not an overly religious poet necessarily, the gardener comes in a lot in this book, right? There's this overarching figure of the gardener, who of course we have to sometimes read to be God a little bit. But that in this poem, she's giving us the same subject and theme, but in some ways trying to give us, to put us into the experience itself, rather than having us talk about the experience. Does that kind of make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, sorry we, try as I might, we kind of rushed through this last, I'm sorry we didn't take as much time with the wild iris, because it does have just as many sort of layers and depth, and I would encourage you to take it with you and read it again or something. Yeah, Ingrid, last, yeah.
The wild iris has elegant and exquisite expressions of sorrow and poignant. I mean, at the end of my suffering, there was a door. Hear me out, that which you call death, I remember. And then this terrible, it's terrible survivor's consciousness buried in the dark earth. What a strong image for us that is. Buried alive. Consciousness.
That consciousness is under there, yeah.
And it's, so it's all that incredibly, speaking as the voice of a flower who's been through death and is describing it to us, it's rich stuff.
Yeah.
And then these three pieces at the end, the voice inside a voice inside a voice, and the final truth is the spectacular deep blue shadows on azure seawater.
Yeah.
And you're...
I know, this. Yeah.
I'm wondering if this poem did not have a title, if we'd know what it was about, and if we read it titleless, what we would title it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think that is a terrific question. And I think you should check out the rest. And part of what she's doing, I think, is very much... I mean, because we can't read it... it's difficult not to read it as a human speaker going through a time of grief as well, right? That in some ways the flower is just a mode for a human speaker, right? And she is very good. She has this other book called Meadowlands, where that deals with the story of Odysseus and Penelope, the Odyssey. So she has a lot of what we call this a persona poem, right? When the speaker is a person other than the poet, right? And so in that book, some of the poems are like from the perspective of Odysseus or Penelope, but then interspersed, she also has contemporary poems about a dissolving marriage. And so what you start to see is the sort of myth overlapping. And so soon Penelope's voice and Odysseus's voice, you know, become sort of interchangeable. And similarly in The Wild Iris, she has many poems entitled like Vespers. And so we have a sense of an actual poet speaker also talking about subjects of grief and dying and stuff. And so you're totally right on in the sense that throughout the book, the way that these two sort of start to intertwine and intermingle become really interesting. So,
I just, I'm not sure if this is true of wild iris, but I have iris in my garden.
Yeah.
And the blue iris, as soon as they come up in the top iris, as soon as it dies, it has a double one right with it. And this almost describes to me the first one dying and the second one opening up.
See, this is why it's good to have gardeners in these sessions. You smarty pants. Oh, that's beautiful. So that second sort of...
The second blossom that emerges from the dead one.
Although, I was wondering whether or not, I'm reading this as she's imagining a bulb that you bury and it dies, right? You bury a bulb and it metamorphosizes into a flower after it's died.
But
and
the reason,
I'm imagining that.
The reason I thought that was when the first time I read it through, I thought, she's talking about a near-death experience.
Mm. Oh.
So I mean, I don't know if that would affect other people that way, but that's how I felt it was talking.
Yeah.
Well, that helped me a lot, because I'm back here wondering, who is this you in the poem? That which you call death. This is what you fear, you being a soul and unable to speak. I couldn't figure out, who is this you in the poem?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, especially when you get to the you being a soul and unable to speak, because is she doing a switcheroo on us, where usually we think of flowers as the ones being unable to speak, and now she's kind of pointing at us as the ones who are who are really the voiceless ones, right? And then we get to the end of the poem where it's like voice in voice in voice, and is she trying to put us in the place of being the voiceless one? But I don't know. It's a weird... I think the you is an interesting question. Thanks, all of you guys, for coming. Great insights. And, you know, when you see the wild irises today,